Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thanks for that introduction, Hamilton. Also, thanks for CEDA for inviting me to speak today, and thanks to my colleagues at National Australia Bank here in Adelaide for sponsoring this event. It's certainly a moving sea, I have to say, and I guess as a starting point, I'd also say that most of the things that Terry has said here are, you know, very consistent with the way we view the world. I guess I spent a fair bit of time trying to figure out what all this might mean for the future, and Terry's certainly given us some examples and some things to think about. We need to put hard numbers onto the outlook for the next couple of years, and in terms of our own operations as a bank, our dealing room operations, our relationship with the market, and of course for our clients. So what I'm going to try to do today is to bring this global financial crisis back home, if you like. What does it actually mean for our outlook? Now, how does it affect the interplay of economic and financial forces ahead? What will it mean for our national economy? And there are so many balls in the air at the moment, I'm not going to attempt to try and bring that home to what that means for the South Australian economy, but I'm sure that for many of the things that I'm about to say, that you'll see how the impacts will be different in South Australia than they will be in the eastern states. I couldn't help but do some work over the weekend, I'm afraid, and that's because of the US employment numbers that came out on Friday night. Now, we've been expecting for some time that the US would have a significant recession, not a major recession, but a significant recession, and that would lead to rising unemployment, and that would lead to job shedding in America. It would be a very bleak time in America for a couple of years. Now, the numbers suddenly got a lot worse on Friday night, I have to say. This is a chart that shows you numbers taken from the October labour market report out of the US, and there's a couple of things to note right at the end of this chart, which, you know, when I saw them on Saturday morning, it really shocked me. The first thing is that the unemployment rate in the US is now higher than it was in the early 2000s recession. It's just hit 6.5%. The previous peak in that recession, the grey areas, by the way, on this chart are previous recessions, was 6.3%. So they've already managed to breach that high unemployment rate that we saw after the tech wreck and the US recession in the early 90s. The other thing that shocked me is that we've now seen more than 500,000 jobs lost in the US in the previous 2 months. And in fact, they revised the job losses significantly worse for the month of September. And you can see there at the bottom of that chart, they were sitting at 159,000 job losses in September when I went home on Friday night. By the time we got to Saturday morning, that had been bumped up to around 280,000. So two very significant job losses there. And I guess the third thing about this is that you can see from this chart that usually the unemployment rate keeps rising for a time after the recession is actually over. And by the recession being over, I mean there the GDP figures stop falling. So we hit the trough on output, output starts to rise, but labour shedding continues for some time after that and the unemployment rate rises further. So it looks to me that we're in this sort of early 90s area in terms of where the unemployment rate is going to go in the US. That's a very sort of sobering backdrop for the world economy. The US, of course, is far bigger than China. It's actually bigger in the latest IMF numbers than China and India put together. So that's a very large chunk of the global economy that looks like it's in recession. Pretty sobering stuff. This is where I was going to start before those numbers came out. So I'll go back there, and this is very much along the lines of the themes that Terry was mentioning. And certainly, you know, if you want to look at where this global downturn, this financial crisis has come from, it fundamentally did start with excess lending in America. Alan Greenspan, rates of 1%, clearly with the benefit of hindsight, rates stayed too low for too long. That led to an asset price bubble in the housing market. Central banks still are coming to grips with how to deal with asset markets. They are used to targeting, of course, consumer inflation, but asset price bubbles have been the demise now of the US economy on two occasions, the tech wreck in the early 2000s and now the housing price bubble in the mid-2000s. So asset price bubbles, I think, will be a topic which is going to be the subject of much research from central banks over the next few years as they figure out how to deal with asset price bubbles. The clever bankers on Wall Street, of course, packaged up those loans that were made to subprime mortgages, people that never were going to be able to repay those mortgages, packaged them up into very difficult to unjumble packages of securities that they sold off to investors all around the world. And there's the answer of where they look as of Friday night. These are all investment grade securities, by the way. They were AAA or BBB minimum rated by companies such as Standard & Poor's and Moody's and Fitch. So Australian government local councils quite rightly said they're investment grade, we should invest in them. That means they're low risk. Well, as you can see there, some of them now worth about 5 cents in a dollar. So, you know, a lot of people did a lot of money over this, and unfortunately, for the global financial sector, a lot of banks were invested very heavily into these securities. Now, there's a timeline here, which I won't go through, which shows you the progression, if you like, of the problems in the financial markets. And as Terry said, you know, subprime first was mentioned in The Australian in March 2007, but it certainly didn't start to get much traction in terms of wide media coverage until Bear Stearns started to cough up problems and eventually froze funds in July 2007. And from then on, of course, we've seen a litany of disasters, as you can see here. I guess the point I'd make is, you know, the failure of Lehman Brothers here, the Northern Rock problems here, Bear Stearns, you know, eventually freezing funds and being allowed to go belly up. All of these things, of course, really destroyed confidence in the banking sector. That meant, of course, that banks would actually got very negative about lending to each other. And trying to bring that back to Australia, this is the number one thing which is uppermost in my mind about how this affects Australia, at least in the short term. In the more medium term, it depends what happens on the global economy. But this was the impact for the Australian banks, which Terry said, you know, quite rightly, had gradually started to access more and more funds from offshore, and most of those offshore funds came in the form of 2 to 3 year funding in terms of bank bonds that are mainly issued into Europe. Now, normally that funding, by normally I mean before March 2007, normally that funding was available at interest rates of 10 to 15 basis points above the swap rate. At the moment, banks pay 80 to 100 basis points above the swap rate for that money. So the cost of those funds has gone up dramatically if you can get it, if you can get it. Now, you know, no bank will tell you this. They all say, oh, yes, the latest issue we did was oversubscribed and well subscribed. But the fact is, and I know from talking to people across all the banks, they would have raised more money in the past 12 months from issuing bonds into Europe and into the international financial markets than they've actually done so if the investors had been there willing to stump up more money. So there's actually a shortage of funds available even at these higher prices. So that's the long end of the funding. I mean, in rough arithmetic, if you look at the funding at the moment for the Australian banks as a block, they get about 50% of their funds from deposits, another 25% from this form of funding, from medium-term funding by issuing bonds, and another 25% from the short-term wholesale money markets. Now, this has been an area of acute shortage of funds over the last 6 months or so, and really it's been going on since, you know, way back into the 2007 period, but it's actually got much worse very recently. This is the cost of a bank borrowing by issuing a three-month bank bill over and above the cash rate. Again, the banks used to be able to raise this sort of money for 10 to 15 basis points over the cash rate. As you can see at the moment at Australia, it's running at about 50 basis points over the cash rate, has been up to 100 basis points over the cash rate, and you can see here in the US it got up to astronomical levels. But the point I'd make is that these rescue packages are actually working. And I guess the thing that I look at every day is what has happened to the cost of bank funding overseas for 3 months. This is the area where you'd expect to see some traction if the packages that have been introduced all around the world, including by our government, if they are actually working. And at the moment, I think this chart is telling us that they are getting some traction because the cost of three-month money is coming down globally. I could put a chart up there with many more countries on it, but take my word for it that globally we're starting to see the cost of funds come down. It's still obviously very elevated, but nevertheless it is coming down. So the ingredients in these rescue packages, which have become now, I think, standard practice amongst policymakers around the world, are fairly simple. And, you know, again, Terry's already given you the bones of this, but, you know, just to kind of put it into a more structured sense, the ingredients are basically that you ensure the deposits of your major financial institutions. That, of course, was part of that decision taken on that Sunday that Terry talked about. Ensure the bank's deposits, clearly aimed to stop a run on retail deposits amongst the Australian banks, deposit-taking institutions registered with the Reserve Bank. The second thing you do is you guarantee the bonds that the banks issue. That means that counterparties will be prepared to take those bonds, lend their money to the banks, because they have a government guarantee that they'll get their capital back when the bond comes due in 2 or 3 years. The same also applies, by the way, to 2 to 3 year funding. The intention is that any instrument issued by a bank, if the bank wants to pay the insurance, will be guaranteed by the government. And the third thing that has happened, particularly in Europe and in America, is that they actually inject capital into the banks to shore up the capital base of the banks. And before that happened, the global financial system was way short of the amount of capital it needed, given the losses that have been revealed over the past 12 months. But with these injections now, it appears that they've effectively caught up, if you like. They've plugged the hole of capital. Now, note that in Australia's case, we haven't needed that equity injection because, as we keep being told by the authorities, don't take it from me, that the reserve, that the local banks are well capitalised and profitable. Hence, no need to inject equity into the local banks. Note also that the major economies to our north haven't introduced any of these policies so far. They haven't needed to. So that's a fundamental difference between the developed world and the Western world, the Western democracies. And at this point, I want to talk about the economic outlook, because I think this is a very important point for Australia. It's all very easy to get swept up in the news out of the developed economies because it's more regular, it's well reported here. But actually, over the last 12 months or so, we've seen much better types of things happening in China. Now, before I do that, though, I just wanted to talk a little bit about the equity markets, because the equity markets have been pricing effectively a global depression. It wasn't so long ago I could put this chart up and you'd see that black line, which is the most recent event, wasn't going through the 87 stock market crash. So each of these shows you the peak to trough of stock markets for a number of issues. The green line there is the 2000-2001 problems, the 87 stock market crash. The blue line, of course, is the Great Depression crash. So effectively, the markets a couple of weeks ago, were effectively pricing in another Great Depression. That's the only way you can look at it. We have got a bounce, though. Those numbers are as of Friday, so it doesn't take into account the Friday night bounce of almost 3% in the US stock markets, but this is the Dow Jones peak trough, so we are seeing a little bit of an uptick there. This is another way of looking at it. So you'll get a lot of people talking about the stock markets. I heard one day last week the biggest points fall ever in the US stock markets. This is the S&P 500, a broader measure than the Dow. And we've logged it. The reason why we log it is because that takes away, if you like, the base effect. Obviously, 100 points fall when you've got an index up at 10,000 is quite a lot different to 100 points fall when you're down at 500. So we log it to take away that base effect. And this gives you an idea about the peaks and the troughs. You see it quite clearly. So, you know, recently that's the NASDAQ sort of tech wreck issue there. Obviously a bubble there, running above trend. And down the bottom here, the red line shows you the deviation from trend of the stock markets. And I guess a couple of points I'd make from that. Number one is that in the latest episode, it looked like the market was running a little above trend and therefore you might say a bit overpriced, but not dramatically so. Not dramatically so. And I guess the look where we are now with this big downturn that's come through, and you can see we're right back to levels that we haven't seen except for the Great Depression, except for the First and Second World Wars, and except for the period of the 70s and early 80s when we had double-digit inflation and massive oil price shocks. So I guess the point I'd make is that, again, the stock markets appear to be pricing in, or were pricing in. I know they've been a little bit better over the last day or so, but still I think the analysis would hold. Were pricing in about the worst possible scenario that you could possibly imagine for the global economy and the US. That's not the central case. So this is our current set of forecasts for the global economy in Australia, and I guess I've highlighted there in the middle of this table our current set of forecasts for the major developed economies, the US, Japan, the UK and Europe, all in recession. But you'll see there for China, we have a floor of 7.5%, and for India, we've got a floor of 6.5%. Those two economies certainly slowed down dramatically, and that's mainly a result of reduced exports. But, you know, the point I'd make is that those two economies are still looking reasonably solid. I mean, if we see China grow at 7.5%, that's the bottom, then that means that they're going to need an awful lot of coal and iron ore. Now, I should also say that I feel much more confident in that prediction this morning than I did on Friday. That was starting to look like, okay, do we need to go a little bit lower than 7.5? It's pretty obvious that with the package announced yesterday out of China, that the authorities will do what it takes to ensure that 7.5% is the bottom on their economy, and possibly even higher than that. The value of this fiscal package they've announced, $586 billion. $586 billion. 15% of Chinese GDP over 2 years. 15% of Chinese GDP. 4% of the US GDP. 4% of US GDP. Think about that. And they're going to make a big start on it in the fourth quarter of this year. It was one of my colleagues back in Sydney that I was speaking to on the way over here said they'll probably build a couple of airports between now and the end of the year with that sort of money around. That's the extent to which China can organise itself. So it comes back to a point I was going to make to you anyway about the outlook for China. And to get to that point, I suppose it's worth remembering that China's contribution to global growth in the past year was equal to both Europe and America put together. So China's contribution to global growth is really, really important. That's really important for Australia because that drives commodity demand. Yes, China's been slowing down, but to me the key reason for that slowdown is because their exports to the developed world have stopped growing so rapidly. But meanwhile, domestic demand indicators have seen no down blip at all so far. These latest numbers are up to the end of September. This shows you business fixed investment in real terms and retail trade in nominal terms. The business fixed investment reflects the urbanisation, industrialisation of China. The retail trade numbers reflects the urbanisation of China. More and more people in jobs where they get paid money, they can actually go out and buy things instead of being on subsistence farming types of incomes, right? No income, you just live on what you produce. This is really, really important in terms of, you know, the ongoing growth in China. That's why I've said 7.5% a couple of times. In our view, that's the bottom that they can let the economy slip to without any increase in exports. In other words, if the economy keeps industrialising and urbanising, it'll still grow at 7.5% without there being any growth from exports. So that's kind of where we get that number from. As I've said, after this package, you know, we're much more convinced that this is the likely outlook. Now, the slowdown in global demand will definitely have an impact on commodity prices. In fact, we have a 30% drop in commodity prices in our forecast there. But you have to remember that even a 30% drop in commodity prices is not a disaster compared to where they were in the mid-1990s. You know, effectively, commodity prices will still remain, you know, some 20 or 30% above where they were. So these are very good commodity prices. And here's one of the things I really agree with Terry on, that this will nevertheless put a lot more focus on costs amongst the mining companies in Australia. Because at the moment, they've been prepared to pay anything effectively to dig the stuff out of the ground because they could get whatever price they had to demand from the purchasers. However, when you start to see the prices come off, there'll be more concentration on costs, and really that's no bad thing. Now, all of this all of this global strength that we've seen recently showed up in very strong business conditions and so on. Terry's told you the story. The Reserve Bank wanted to slow the economy down, and certainly that's been working. Okay, there's no doubt about that. It's happening. It showed up in our NAB business survey. It's a national survey published monthly and also quarterly. We've got another one coming out tomorrow. And you can see there the dramatic drop in business confidence. But to us, the more important measure is business conditions. That's a measure of what actually happened to firms in the survey. It's based on employment, on profitability and trading conditions. And we asked the firms, have you increased your employment, say? Is it the same or have you decreased it? And we add up a net balance. So basically we do that for each of those three components, trading, profitability and employment. And you can see there that basically we're at a level where a net balance of 5% of firms are telling us that their business conditions deteriorated in the latest month. So business conditions have really come off against an economy that's slowing down. House prices, an area that you'd expect to be hit by increases in interest rates. And certainly that's happened. These numbers just came out last week. These are the third quarter numbers. The little table here, and I'm sorry for you people down the back, this is probably hard to read. But if you see, when you see this presentation later, you'll see that for all the mainland capital cities, there were falls in house prices in the latest quarter. That's the actual level of house prices on the chart here, and you can see again, now most of them have started to turn down. Interest rate increases work. It slows down things that are interest rate sensitive. Another example of this is in building approvals. Building approvals at the moment really are stunningly weak. I think they're more 21% down on a year ago across the country. This is against a country with strong population growth and therefore strong formation of households across the entire community. But yet, you know, our rate of building has slowed down dramatically. It's lower than it was by 20% compared to this time last year. Now, again, the key reason for that is because investors were refusing to borrow and put that money into housing. They're unwilling to take that bet, given that house prices haven't done much, given that interest rates are so high. Now, you know, again, that's an example to me of the lagged effect, if you like, of the increase in interest rates we saw before. Of course, a household's major asset remains its house. So the downturn in house prices, the high mortgage rates cut into consumer spending. Again, this is what the Reserve Bank wanted. It wanted to see the Australian economy slow down. It's getting plenty of examples of that now. And I guess a very important example is on the unemployment rate in the labour market. Now, absolutely no doubt the labour market's been too tight for comfort over the last year or two, and certainly it's been uppermost in the mind of the Reserve Bank that it would lead to a wages splash. But now we've got clearly the rate of employment growth trending. And by the way, the monthly numbers are even worse than they used to be because in their wisdom, the Bureau of Statistics have decided to cut one of the most important monthly surveys, in my opinion, they produce, and that's on the labour market, because of budget cuts of 2%. So that means that these numbers are even more unreliable month to month than they used to be. By the way, you would have seen, I've got to tell you this, it's just so appalling. When those labour market numbers came out last week, I think the number was up 34,000. I've almost given up remembering what it is exactly now. But I looked at what the 95% confidence interval was on that employment survey. It was somewhere between down 25,000 and up 96,000. That's where the number lay, right? In other words, take a guess, it was probably positive, right? But so we're putting a lot more weight now on the trend numbers, which take out some of the month-to-month volatility. Trend employment growth is growing at 8,800. That's not enough to stop the unemployment rate rising, and that's what we've seen. The unemployment rate bottomed at 3.9%. It's now running at 4.3%, and in our view, it's going to go higher. So we think that in 2010, we'll see the unemployment rate peak out at over 6%, around 6.25% in the early part of 2010. So certainly we've got a higher unemployment rate there. Now, all this doom and gloom, though, you know, again, I'd say you can see a lot of that is about households and about consumption, about retailing. The important thing to remember is that the mining sector and the infrastructure the development that this economy needs is there sitting on the blocks ready to go. This is a chart which shows you what all of the state governments planned to do when they brought their budgets down in May. Now, when that happened and we put these numbers together, we thought there's no way they're actually going to be able to do all that. There's just not enough spare resources in the economy to do that without pushing the inflation rate not above 3%, but above 5%. So one of the things that I take comfort from is that if we see a downturn in the economy that's greater than anybody expects, then the governments around the country can ramp up their infrastructure spending, put more of this stuff in place, and therefore provide a cushion to the economy. And certainly the private sector has a massive amount of investment on the drawing board at the moment. These are projects which are sort of beyond the drawing board, the feasibility studies. These are live projects about to go, $120 billion in total over the next few years. Fair bit of it concentrated in WA, but you can see there a couple of big chunks concentrated in South Australia as well. So, you know, this mining sector stuff is very important for the economy. So when I look ahead, yes, we have a weak economy. Our forecast for GDP for the next 12 months is 1.3% in 2009. The latest figures from the Reserve Bank today averaged out at about 1.5%. They're a little softer, apparently, than the Treasury's forecast in its mid-year review. But we still don't think that's low enough. And the point that I'd make is that quite a bit of that does come from mining and agriculture. Now, I know that from talking to my colleagues here that the outlook for the wheat crop and the grain crop in South Australia is not as good as it might have been. But around the country, we're looking for a substantial increase in the wheat and grain crop up to about the average levels of the past decade. That will be a massive boost to GDP by itself. So that underpins our 1.3% forecast of the economy overall. But I have to tell you, if you take out mining and agriculture, we're back to 0.5%. So for the parts of the economy that don't have much exposure to those particular sectors, and think about what that means geographically, Sydney and Melbourne, it's going to be feeling very much like a recession over the coming 12 months. Less consumer goods, less imports, less housing, more investment, more mining, more exports. From a medium-term perspective, economically, you know, that's a good rebalancing of the economy. But it is going to mean pain for particular sectors, and I guess, you know, in particular for smaller manufacturers and so on in the big cities in Australia. So where's the RBA go from here? Well, there's no doubt. I think Terry takes the accolades for a great call on the Reserve Bank on the morning of it. There was no forecaster in the market expecting that the RBA would cut by 70 basis points. The most forecasters were tipping that rates would be cut by 50, down to 5.5. I think there was one that only thought there'd be 25. So they surprised the market and the forecasters in the market with a significant cut in interest rates of 75, 200 basis points over the past 3 months, a really massive fiscal stimulus. Monetary stimulus on top of the fiscal stimulus that we've seen from the government, the $10.4 billion. So, you know, really the authorities have taken major steps. We kind of looked at the forecast that came out in the quarterly monetary policy statement today and came to the conclusion that they almost seem to be implying that they've done enough now. They've left their cash rate forecast at 5.25%, whereas the Treasury actually moved away from its normal practice of assuming the current cash rates where it stays. The Treasury assumed the market pricing for cash rates rules. So the Reserve Bank has basically the economy rebounding to about 3% during 2009-10, but it's also pushed out its inflation forecast, so inflation doesn't get back into the target band until end of 2010, early 2011, whereas previously they'd said it would be in the second half of 2010. Seems to suggest that maybe they're thinking they're coming to the end of it. We don't think so, basically. We think they're going to keep cutting interest rates further from here. We think they'll probably do another 75 basis points in December, and that the trough in the cash rate will be around 3.75%. Now, those numbers will be published officially tomorrow in our NAB business survey. They may change at the margin between now and when we put that to bed tonight, but basically that's where we're going at the moment. That would be very stimulatory monetary policy settings, because the bottom so far since the Reserve Bank started targeting the cash rate is 4.25%, which happened in the early 2000s. So going down to 3.75, another 50 basis points lower, very stimulatory monetary policy. That's based on our view that the authorities, both the government through fiscal policy, the Reserve Bank through monetary policy, will do whatever it can to make sure that this economy doesn't have a recession and that the downturn is mitigated to the extent that they can do it. Last but not least, I'm going to talk about the Australian dollar. And it's not my job to forecast the Australian dollar, by the way. It's our currency forecast, John Kyriakopoulos, and by geez, I'm glad that's been his job over the last while. It's certainly been a moving feast. You know, we think we know what's driving it, but the extent of these moves are just incredibly difficult. And I suppose a good way to think about that is that of the 10 largest movements in the Australian dollar since it was floated in December 1983 were all in October of this year. All in October of this year. One day there was a 7-cent range on the Australian dollar's trade. So, you know, to forecast this is very, very difficult. To tell you in terms of, you know, where we think the currency should settle, apart from all this massive volatility in it, if we use a 4.5% cash rate and a 30% reduction in commodity prices, it says to us that the fair value on the currency ought to be 67 to 70 cents. If we take the cash rate down to 3.75, we're more looking like a 60 to 62 cent currency. Now, we've already been to 60.09 as being the low. At those sort of levels, you know, it looks like, again, it's priced in too much bad news. But, you know, if we do see the cash rate cut that far, then, you know, going down to those sorts of levels suggests that we'll see a currency at some point under 60 cents, because we know that, you know, these model forecasts that we put together have got at least a 2 cent range either side in terms of, you know, one standard deviation away from the fair value reading. So we could, you know, easily see a 58 cent currency or even lower than that on a day when you see, you know, a wall of sellers and no buyers for the Australian dollar. So for what it's worth, there's a few views on the currency. And here's some hard numbers I'll put up for you on the outlook for our economy and some of the major variables there. Probably should tell you that I think all these numbers are correct as of now, although certainly these cash rate forecasts, we will be officially dropping these in the next 24 hours or so when we release our business survey for October, which is coming out 11:30 tomorrow. But apart from that, I should say to you, I put this chart up not so long ago with all these forecasts on it, and there was an error in it that I noticed just at the time. And I, you know, it was something like, you know, the currency might have been 80 cents instead of 70. And I said to people, look, apologies for this error in the chart. That should be 80, not 70. And some bright spark piped up, we'll come back next year, mate, and we'll tell you exactly where all the rest of your mistakes in your table are. So, so I hope I get that privilege with this audience as well. So on that note, I'll leave it now and hand you back to Hamilton.